Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Too Many Minutes, a One Heat Minute Productions podcast miniseries cracking the code of Phil Alden Robinson's 1992 tech caper, Sneakers. To decode this evergreen, era-bridging, infinitely rewatchable masterpiece, we're splitting the film into its component parts, much like its multi-generational ensemble cast for the ages. Since seeing Sneakers in cinemas all the way back in 1992, I've been trying to deconstruct the alchemy. Why does every single element harmonize so perfectly? Is it the score, the compositions, the performances, the script, the setting, the subject, the actors? After 32 years, I finally cracked it. I found Janus's little black box.
Don't look. Listen.
Just as director and co-writer Phil Adam Robinson realized in the casting of Redford at the time, having someone older made everything about the character better, more regretful, and ultimately more resonant. And it was that decision, casting Redford, that cascaded like dominoes. For starters, you immediately get an all-star cast. Redford was cast, Poitier is ready to play, Kingsley, Aykroyd, Strathairn, Phoenix, McDonnell. Just how Redford joining changes how one can interpret Martin Bishop. The addition of each new cast member, each new voice, each new tone, what's on the page doesn't just bring them together, rather it becomes the framework to support what all these actors mean then and mean now to movie lovers across the decades. Phil Adam Robinson becomes a music producer as much as a director, remixing and sampling these performances, turning up the volume on their very specific music. This is a supergroup, so let's dig in and see how each bar, each sample, makes Sneakers a best of album at the jump. In episode 2, you're going to hear from author, screenwriter, and podcaster Lee Zachariah. You're going to hear from New York-based writer, editor, and director, and recently author of The Miss May Does Not Exist, The Life and Work of Elaine May, Hollywood's Hidden Genius Biography, Carrie Corrigan. You're going to hear from film critic, video essayist, filmmaker, and author of But God Made Him a Poet, Watching John Ford in the 21st Century, Scout Tafoya. And you're also going to hear from Phil Alden Robinson, writer and director of Sneakers. You know, I could have been in the NSA, but they found out my parents were married.
So, like, nobody really credits Redford for being as innately versatile as he is. He's like a West Coast mountain guy, right? He grew up in California, he went to college in Colorado, and is most closely associated with Utah. And he's hardly a chameleonic actor. Like, there's a Redford type. So why does he fit into any place you plug him into? Like, you buy him as the East Coast reporter in All the President's Men. You buy him as a salty sea dog in All Is Lost, which is the one that most blew me away. I'm like, oh yeah, salty sea dog Robert Redford. No, wait a second. He's in a mountain in Utah. What am I thinking? And I think that's why you buy him as a computer hacker in Sneakers. And I don't think there's ever been an actor who seemed naturally less like a hacker, but who fit the role as well as he did. Like, he just has this natural gift about him. He is the natural in more yes. ways than... we have to talk about the Redford double take. It is the finest double take in history, and I think the reason is that it's actually a triple take. Nobody, but nobody conveys what, wait, are you serious in a glance better than Redford? And there's no film where he deploys it better than in this one. He just keep an eye out for it. It's just like glance, second glance, third glance. Wait, what? It cracks me up every time. Nobody does that better.
It's you just got me straight back to, and the CIA, like the wonderful scene in All the President's Men is like, yeah, and the CIA. When he's talking about Howard Hunt, he's like, and the CIA, like a triple double take to himself on the phone, the best like individual reaction acting, like talk about a reacting acting exercise that just has to keep, you know, evolving.
That's almost like the birth of it, All the President's Men. You see it so many times where he's just, you see it on his face that he's processing it.
He's processing that information. It's really hard to do, and to do well without boring the shit out of the audience.
Look at his goofy reaction when James Earl Jones yells at him. Like when he says, come on, the FBI had given twins, and he goes, no. Or is it, you can chaperone. It's one of those lines where he just gets screamed at no. And Redford reacts like he's in a Laurel and Hardy movie. Like, I cannot imagine too many movie stars of that generation in a film like that going that goofy, that hard. And it's so funny, and it's so perfectly pitched. And then you contrast that with like 30 seconds later, it's the final moment of the film. You know, can't they just hook it up and do bad things with it? And he holds up a chip and says, nope. And it's just the most underplayed, like even that nope that I just did is 10 times bigger than how he did it. Yeah. And it just, like, nobody sells a moment better than him. Like, as he goes as big as he has to, he goes as small as he has to, and it's within the space of 30 seconds. And he's one of the greats.
So, Carrie, first up, when did you first see Sneakers?
I think I first saw Sneakers sometime in 7th or 8th grade. If I recall correctly, it was definitely like late middle school. I had the sort of experience that you had mentioned earlier where like it was sort of this film where, or I went on like a sort of spiral where I think I had like sort of discovered Redford a little bit earlier. And I was like, I'm going to watch every Robert Redford movie. I like this guy. And Sneakers came up and I was like, oh my God, this movie rules. I love this. This is what a fun time. To like 13, 14 year old brain, it was just a sort of like spy romp.
I love that. And also I was smiling as you were saying that, because I'm like, maybe I still have that 13 or 14 year old brain, because every time I watch Sneakers, I'm still like, this movie absolutely rules. But I think that's, you know, ultimately the thesis of this show is that it is a gateway to so many amazing actors, filmmakers, and particularly genres. And I think I love that you're situating it in that spy romp area and espionage. But like, I found it so young too, and it had to be the first, if not like the first or second movie I'd ever seen with Robert Redford at the age that I saw it. I was really young. I saw it in theaters when I was a kid. It was like one of my formative cinematic experiences. I think others had been like the Ninja Turtles movie, Batman, that I can remember, you know, Terminator 2. And then I saw this little, you know, what felt like a little tiny indie movie in comparison to those gargantuans. And I was like, who are all these people that are so amazing? And I think your phenomenal piece that you wrote for Brightwall about this really digs and weaves the tendrils through that, like, that kind of reflections and echoes of of a person's career that Redford is able to conjure. So could we, like, could you help me navigate that and what Redford is doing here that is so unique and also so specific to him?
I think what it is that I've noticed, like, I think, like, I'm very drawn to late Redford,
yes,
like 80s, mid 80s on. Mm. And it's a string of roles that are not like, they're not his most well-known. They're not his best performances, clearly. Mm. But I think in each of them, and particularly in Sneakers, he's reaching back and he's kind of performing different versions, older versions of characters he's already played before.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's like typecasting. I don't know if it's a little bit like, you know, in Hollywood, sort of, we don't know what to do with you if you're an older actor of any gender. And I think like in Sneakers, he's sort of bringing this little, like, I think it's mostly like 3 Days of the Condor in this. Yeah. It's like, he's sort of like, what if that character is now like washed up and old, and like, this is what he's doing now. It seems connected in a way.
Yeah. It's like a trap in a positive way personally that I love, which is that these huge stars of the 70s, particularly men and women across the board, carry with them this like huge, it's almost like a freight train of these personas and these huge influential characters that are almost inescapable. So when they get cast, as Robert Redford, the entity, the brand. And it's like, you know, sometimes that's why people will say like, oh, like Tom Cruise, he's doing these things. He used to be in movies that, you know, were directed by, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson or, you know, Stanley Kubrick, etc. But you're like, no, it's the same with Pacino and De Niro. It's like, no, they can't escape their history. And so they always have to be aware of it and in sort of contest with it. And Redford's one of those guys that I think, and like a couple of the guys in Sneakers, that like, if you cast Sidney Poitier, you're casting Sidney Poitier. And if you cast Robert Redford, it's Robert Redford. It's Sundance, guys. It's like Bob Woodward. Like, it's one of the most important actors of his generation and then filmmakers of his generation. So I feel like, for me, I love the baggage that they bring. The fact that he was older and he'd lost a step, but he still had this youthful energy and this cheek and that wry smile, as you reference, and the kind of like, we're getting too old for this shit genre of movies that this movie becomes, it's able to harness all those things. So I think that that's what your piece and that's what your observations, that's, I feel like so many movie stars want to disappear, but sometimes it's not about disappearing. It's addressing the elephant in the room that you are like one of the biggest movie stars in the world, and then embracing that and making this character part of your kind of persona that keeps coming through. I don't know if you feel that.
No, for sure. I think you feel that. And I think the thing too is that in earlier performances of anyone, like anyone who has a type, any of those guys, you don't feel it so much. You don't notice so much that maybe there's this expectation to perform the persona in each role, or like there are higher stakes. But I think the thing I love most about Sneakers is that, yes, it comes with that baggage. And yes, it's like, you know, you're watching Robert Redford, and Robert Redford knows he's playing the persona of Robert Redford. But it's like, it's almost as if being older and having that baggage, and like, he knows he's a star, he knows he's good, like, he doesn't have anything to prove. I think it loosens his performance, and I think it just makes it more relaxed and lived in and fun. Like, above all else, when I watch this, I'm like, you can tell everybody making this movie had a blast making this movie, which yes, you can't make up.
Especially Phoenix, especially Dan Aykroyd, especially Shathan, like the chemistry of all those guys, like the scene where they're communicating to like Bishop while he's in Donald Logue's character's office with Elena Rishkoff, and they're all in the van, and they're all that silliness of those guys like telling him what to say and scripting him live and him hearing it and saying the words.
I don't understand. Yeah, sometimes I don't understand myself. Here, look, I might lose my license for this, but my client is a vindictive, bitter woman. She's been withholding marital favors from Gunther for many, many years, and now she's out to ruin him.
And she's using you to get to her.
And she's using you, me to get to her, you. I know that's confusing, but don't you see what's happening here? You and me, we're just pawns in this ugly little game.
If you love him. If you love him.
If you love him. If you really love him, then just keep on loving him. And never let him know that you know what he thinks you don't know, that you know. You know?
And give him head whenever he wants.
Give him head. Help. Be a beacon in his sad and lonely life. Can you do that for Gunther?
Yes, I can. I can.
Okay, good. Now get out of here. Give him head.
Be a beacon.
I don't know how they didn't just ruin the movie, like shooting that for like 15 days, because they just completely kill each other laughing. They all look like they're having the best time. And it just feels like, yeah, there's an infectiousness to that. They really sell it to hell that they're having the best time. And Phil Adam Robinson's like, oh yeah, sometimes I had to calm them down because they were being too silly. You know, they were having too much fun.
That's great though. Like that's, like you said, like there are movies you can tell where like it's supposed to be, and I'm struggling to think of one now too, where it's supposed to be like a group endeavor, and it's supposed to be like a group of people who are like old friends, great friends, they have fun together, and it's like every single person in this movie, when they call cut, they're like going back to their individual trailers and not speaking to each other. Like yes. That's the vibe that comes across.
Well,
but not with this.
No, you're an Elaine May scholar, though. So the big one is Cassavetes and Peter Falk.
Oh, for sure.
Mikey and Nikki, but also all of Cassavetes' movies. Those two guys, you can feel that they love each other. Like there's something, when you see them on screen, you're like, these men love each other. It's undeniable.
Yeah, definitely. And it's just something that like you can't cast for that.
No.
Which is why it's so interesting in Sneakers. Like you have no idea what's going to happen. I mean, obviously you might do chemistry reads, or you might do a few like early takes or something, or rehearsals, or you might say like, oh, it's not working in rehearsal, maybe we replace somebody. But like, that's what's interesting. Like none of these guys, to my knowledge, were friends before this started.
It's funny that just talking to you now, it's one of the first times I've thought about it. But in 1992, that's also the year of Unforgiven, where Clint Eastwood gets to basically rewrite, as kind of John Wayne had done, you know, basically 50 years or 40 years earlier at the time with the Searchers, like rewrite the history of the Western archetype that he had created for himself. So like Clint's, you know, Man with No Name and Outlaw Josie Wales and all those huge Western, High Plains Drifter, all the huge Westerns that were revisionist and things like that in the 70s, the Dirty Harry of it all. And then he comes back in Unforgiven, and the myth of who Clint is so much a part of the character that he plays in that movie that all the choices that he makes against type and that he denies us of the kind of classic Clint are also important for how you get to the conclusion of that movie. And I think that in the same way, but in maybe a way more sort of casual and less overt way, Redford is doing that so subtly in Sneakers. He's just doing like, yes, I'm the guy from The Sting, you know, one of the greatest heist movies of all time. And yes, I'm the guy from 3 Days of the Condor, one of the coolest espionage movies of all time. And it's like, yes, I'm that guy who like investigates and digs in one of my favorite movies of all time, All the President's Men. But he's kind of doing that same thing. And it's so funny that at this time, these two gigantic stars, two of like the last movie stars, were there doing this thing at the same time, just completely on divergent paths. One for like popcorn and romp purposes, and one for like kind of Western prestige. It's really funny that it happened in that sort of confluence at the same time.
Well, I think it's interesting that you bring that up, because I think that's, I mean, they're both the last, like some of the last movie stars, but they're also movie stars who became filmmakers. And I think they have a clear idea of narrative, whether it's like the film they're working on or the narrative that they've crafted or has been crafted for them that they're involved in. And I think it's, you know, maybe a thing with age of like, you know, you've accomplished so much and you're still here, and like looking at your third act and thinking, how do I grow from where I've been? Like, how do I do something different that acknowledges my past? And I think, yeah, they both do it in different ways, but it's essentially just a, how do I undo the myth of me, or how do I acknowledge the myth of my persona? They're both kind of like the same, even though they're different approaches. It's just like, how do you structure the narrative from here? How do you structure the narrative of your third act, I guess?
Yeah. And if you're lucky enough, you still get to tell that story. Like, I think, although he's done a couple of voices and done a cameo, like 2018's The Old Man and the Gun, which is his last like actual big screen performance, is so deeply red. Like, it's so deeply like an impossible movie to make without Redford, like as Redford being there, like charming the pants off of people and doing that and being wily and clever and doing all those sorts of things, that it's like, yeah, like someone who is in so much control. And whether you like it or not, it's why fascinating viewing is Prime Archer. Like, it's like, you know, Eastwood in front of a camera at 90 or something, like recently. It's like such a fascinating thing to watch this guy who, you know, you're barely surprised he can't even like turn up on a movie, let alone make one. He's in his 90s, for God's sake. But it's just one of those things where you see him in front of the camera and you're like, oh, this might be the last time that I see this favorite persona. And what's the last note in the memoir that he's giving us in this performance? And I think that, yeah, we were so, you know, we were obviously like 20 years, nearly 30 years away from that with Redford. But I think here, like you said, the third act, this is the most overt, like little run. You know, you talk about it in your great piece of like, it's kind of like it's Sneakers and then it's The Last Castle and it's Up Close and Personal and it's and as The Horse Whisperer, and it's this second part of his career where he gets to sort of, I don't know, rewrite or revisit elements and aspects of previous characters and then do new things with them.
Yeah. And have, I think in a lot of them too, I mean, I don't know about The Horse Whisperer because it's so dramatic, but like having fun with it, like embracing this element of play that is acting. And I think it's interesting too, because even his misses are still like well-made films, and he's never, I don't know, he never sinks into this trap that I think a lot of older actors are. And I'm thinking of like De Niro or like Pacino, where they're like, I got to make this film to pay my bills. Like they can make so many, they have these extensive filmographies, but they're loaded with like in the like later stage, loaded with a bunch of really like stupid lowbrow comedies that are like totally beneath them.
Yes.
They're like borderline, I don't know, whatever the male version of like hagsploitation is, just like these old people behaving badly comedies.
I like hagsploitation as a genderless now. I think it's just like, just call it hagsploitation for sure.
Hagsploitation, gender neutral. And I'm sure that a couple of them are like, I'm sure the ones that are like not as bad are like more mainstream comedies. I don't know. Like Meet the Parents or something. Like a comedy like that is probably you want to do it because it's fun.
Intern is a little bit like that with De Niro. But also that, I think that leads us up to like, you can still be shocked, you know, this year, or sorry, in the last year, with Killers of the Flower Moon, I was like, where has this Robert De Niro been? The scariest right. human being in American cinema. Where has he been? Like, he plays such a phenomenally, like, evil embodiment of evil character that's, you know, almost like John Huston from Chinatown. The continuity of that kind of level of evil comes straight through in Killers of the Flower Moon. And you're like, man, can this guy get roles like this? Like, you know, same with The Irishman. It's like, it's, he's still got it. And yet he's making these, you know, bad grandpa and stuff like that. It's just like, this is, yeah, hagsploitation.
And it's like, I guess that some of them are taken, some of them are obviously taken from money, but I think a lot of them are like, I wouldn't blame these filmmakers or these actors for reaching a certain age and thinking, I just want to make something dumb and fun. I just want to have like a fun time making something unserious, which fair, but I don't think it has to be this incredibly large gap between Killers of the Flower Moon and Bad Grandpa. And I think you find the middle ground with somebody like Redford, who has a more like selective filmography, especially as he gets older. But in each of the movies he's making, they're not silly, goofy, stupid, but he's having fun.
Yes.
Like, it seems like he's taken the pressure off of himself to do something like deeply, like, I don't know, to do something that is awards worthy or do something that is going to be his like last hurrah. Even in his last hurrah, even in The Old Man and the Gun, you're like, he's having a ball making that.
If people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that, instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to GundryMD.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/energy. Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to BadlandsRanch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to BadlandsRanch.com/save50 today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So I think the best way to start talking about Redford is using the Robert Mulligan movie Inside Daisy Clover as the proper introduction, because it is a movie about the star system. It's very specifically about grooming young talent until they become, you know, soulless cogs in a machine. And it is only by destruction of the self, whether through, in his case, a Star is Born style suicide, or Natalie Wood's case, where she blows up a house, like a presage to Zabriskie Point. And so that movie is just, you know, you've been sucked into a thing, and the only way out is complete destruction. And Redford had been one of those stars. He had been on television. He had done, a dozen guest appearances on everything from Dr. Kildare to Alfred Hitchcock Presents. He had been everywhere, but he hadn't really made it yet. And so him playing the guy sort of chosen for stardom and all of the horrible things that come with it was the perfect metaphor for that. Because unlike somebody like Warren Beatty, who was a star from the jump, you know, he shows up and makes Splendor in the Grass and you're like, who the fuck is this beautiful man? Who is this Adonis? You know, he's the marble faun. He's just, you know, incredible. Redford had very down the plate, good all-American looks, but he didn't find himself for a minute. You know, he's very good in Daisy Clover, but it's not the kind of performance where you watch that and think, oh, that guy is definitely going to be a star. And that's true of a lot of his early work, where he's in Arthur Penn's The Chase, where Beatty and Penn had been trying to bring French New Wave technique to American cinema the way that Richard Lester and Tony Richardson brought it to England. And they made Mickey One, which didn't go anywhere. And then they made The Chase. And The Chase is a much more conventional film. And it's very funny that that is very much the way that Redford was. If you're trying to do something crazy, you get Beatty. If you're trying to go something very old school Hollywood, you get Robert Redford. Because he was, you know, he was very much in the mold of a Joel McRae. You know, he was very sturdy and he could do many things and he was very charming. But he wasn't an actor that, you know, he was very much a proto Harrison Ford. He didn't do accents, you know, he wasn't going to completely go out on a limb and do the kinds of weird things that even Paul Newman did, who, of course, was another icon of this period. So Barefoot in the Park, Butch and Sundance, those kind of really introduced to him as this, on the one hand, a very neurotic lead, you know, who could do the comedy stuff, sort of a proto Richard Dreyfuss bit. And on the other, the stoic gun hand, who nevertheless still riddled with neuroses. And that was sort of the thing, is he had the waspish exterior. He was a mountain, basically, and you had to chip away at him, sometimes for a while, sometimes not very long at all, to find the bits of him that would fall out. And through this and through the sort of constant projection of weaknesses and deficiencies and the little bits of loathing and mistrust, he builds this incredible image of the guy who is sent in to dismantle the image of America. In Downhill Racer, which is the first one of these, he's an athlete, you know, the perfect Redford idea. You know, he's a downhill skier and, you know, he really loves himself. But that's a portrait of a guy at a crossroads who is being asked too much of and who is asking too much of himself and, you know, doesn't like where his talent and magnetism have gotten him. In Little Foss and Big Halsey by Sid Fury, he's terrific, by the way. There was just a great Blu-ray of that, and he's the villain in that piece. He's the lead, but he's also the villain. He like ruins the life of Michael J. Pollard, who's just this like sweet idiot, and he just destroys his life because because he can't stand himself and he needs, you know, something else to do, and he needs to prove that he's better than that. And like then there's the run of incredible star vehicles that he makes for himself. Like Downhill Racer, great, but it didn't set the world on fire. You know, it wasn't like The Graduate had been or something like that. And that was very much what everybody was going for. And So he makes The Hot Rock, Peter Yates, incredible crime caper based on a Donald Westlake novel. That was the Parker series was Westlake writing no nonsense, you know, really great crime fiction that's very brutal and violent and you know, minimalist. And then the Dortmunder novels were his comedy figures. It was what if Parker wasn't just a killer? What if Parker was kind of a screw up from time to time? And that's, you know, Redford does that stuff perfectly. And then it's The Candidate and Jeremiah Johnson and The Sting, and he's just on top of the world to the point where he plays Jay Gatsby, which he weirdly isn't right for. You'd think he would be, but he can't quite make it work.
It's almost like the best casting move ever is to have him play Jay Gatsby, and then you can totally see the filmmakers and even the studio going like, how did this not work?
How did this not work? Yeah. Fucking Jack Clayton directing, Coppola wrote the script. There is no excuse for that to not work, but it just doesn't, because Gatsby is not it doesn't lend itself to a stately adaptation. And I mean, frankly, it doesn't really lend itself to any adaptation, because we've now seen what like four different attempts at it, and none of them is the right one, where you can't make it maximalist, you can't make it minimalist, and I don't know that it's worth trying to do it in the middle, because at this point, you know, you take little bits of everything that work. But anyway, so Redford, you know, he is that guy. He's sort of this untouchable star, and he only really lets himself go out on a certain limb. But the important stuff that he lets himself do are movies like Beatty about the government lying to you. He makes All the President's Men, and he makes for heaven's sake,
Three Days of the Condor,
very much. And Brubaker too, which is about the prison system. You know, he has causes that he cares about, and that's what he throws his weight behind. And that's why when you finally get to Sneakers in the 90s, that's like the perfect Redford vehicle. Even better in some instances than like the, you know, the kind of first run Redford in the 60s and 70s, because it's again the same thing where he's still trying to make the kinds of movies you know, where you're learning things, you know, from the liberal consciousness about the ways that the government is lying to you. But it posits very beautifully that it didn't work, that the early movies that he was in, you know, his heart was in the right place, but it ultimately didn't work because the system was too big, and no movie, no matter how good, and no actor, no matter how charming and deployed for the right reasons, is not going to completely break the stranglehold of the American government's image on the American public. And so Sneakers, it has him so perfectly in touch with the little, you know, obviously all the Redford ticks are there in place beautifully, which you just love to see, you know, nobody like stalls for time like Redford does. and, you know, it's this thing where he really thought he was past his sell by date here. And then he gets this reminder of why he was interested in doing it in the first place. It is such a strange film, and it really is like wild. And Phil Alden Robinson has such a very strange relationship to nostalgia as well, where he does Field of Dreams, which is just pure boomer, you know, good old days, man, isn't baseball a great, you know, thing. And then he makes Sneakers, which is the complete deflation of that same idea, that it was all nonsense. One of my favorite bits of the show, The Critic, is when they do a sequel to Field of Dreams, and, you know, Babe Ruth comes out and he says, where can a fella get a hooker around here? And Ty Cobb wants to go to a Klan meeting. Like, that's, you know, Billy Martin, I think, just punches him out. Like, that's exactly the thing that a movie like Field of Dreams can't actually admit to, and Sneakers does. And and it does it, again, with all of these incredible relics from different eras and ages, where Strathairn was, for heaven's sake, John Sayles' favorite actor, you know, discovered that guy. And so he becomes an actor associated with the second wave of liberal consciousness movies from the 80s and 90s. River Phoenix, of course, and basically would have been another Redford if he had lived longer.
Yes.
Incredible talent and just beautiful, just completely beautiful and in touch with himself in, you know, again, in that very, like, I guess he was more of a Warren Beatty than he was a Redford, but still, you know, just a gorgeous, gorgeous, you know, performer who was also insanely talented. And then, of course, Sidney Poitier, who was the guy who, you know, took the big steps and really put himself out there to integrate the Hollywood picture. You know, he wasn't doing the Michael Romer stuff. He wasn't a Yaphet Kotto figure whose anger was really what was making all of those performances so electric, is that he is always the everyman who is losing. Sidney Poitier was the guy who was actually going to sit you down and have a conversation with you, and in so doing, changed the way that, you know, everything is, that race is presented in American movies at a certain budget level. Now, of course, this means that there's a pocket of things kind of burrowing underneath of it, and that's where you get black exploitation. But that's, again, Poitier and Redford are these, you know, stand-ins for an era of liberalism that ultimately didn't do enough to fix the past, or sorry, the future. And now they're living through the ramifications of, you tried, you just didn't try hard enough. And he's just, he's so amusing and fun and funny in that film. He really does every, like, you know, and like extremely funny that this predated Indecent Proposal,
yeah,
which is such an ego like movie. Like, that is such a crazy fucking ego movie. Or like Horse Whisperer, you know, he's this guy, he's like the last romantic in the world in these films, even though, you know, there's this like kind of undercurrent of sleaziness. And but I think that Sneakers was just the better use of him, and he was so clearly having more fun doing it, where he's not really objectified in the way that he is in Indecent Proposal or Horse Whisperer. You know, he's just kind of a guy. He's like slightly rumpled. He dresses like, you know, like an out of work.
It's Dad 101.
Yeah.
For us who grew up, you know, in the 90s, like you're like, I've seen my parents dress like this. I've seen them talk like this. And I think that one of the things that is resonant is there was a certain crop of these like radical sort of 60s and 70s or even earlier, like, you know, late, you know, 50s kids who grew up that were radicalized, that wanted to change the world. And then they live these very conservative lives later on, realizing that they failed immensely, like catastrophically. Yep. And that regret, I think you touched on so beautifully, is like, we didn't do enough. And it's also not enough for culture to fight against this on the biggest scale, like in cinema. It's sometimes the very thing that we're doing to deploy actually distracts us from the fight. And I love that's what the ultimate theme of this movie is. Because even Phil Alden Robinson himself says, like, you know, they were thinking about how, as he was writing it, him and Welker and Lasker, when they were writing this thing together, they were all about 10 years younger than Redford. You know, they were the guys who maybe still hadn't quite come to that point where, like, there was no change to be made. Like, there was still a little bit of that hope. There was this sort of post-George Bush senior, like, liberalism is coming back sort of feeling that was in the zeitgeist. So it was like, oh, maybe we're about to make a turn. But what happens is, like, that 10 years later of, like, this steeped in regret, it's like, oh, no, this is actually the movie that we're making. This is actually what it is.
And the tone is just right, because it has this feeling of getting away with something in a way where you know, it's the whole movie is, you know, quite literally about, you know, you've committed a crime without realizing exactly what you've gotten your hands on. But it also has opened them up to the idea that Redford's younger self. And by the way, the guy that got to play him looks exactly like him.
He's unbelievable. Like, one of the best younger castings of all time.
It takes me off guard every time. I'm like, did they digitally do this? It looks just fucking like him. You know, opening it up and realizing that everything that you thought was true actually is true. And, you know, you've got the character, the Dan Aykroyd character, basically just playing himself, who believes in every single conspiracy theory. And at a certain point, the kind of like other shoe dropping and big punchline is, you don't have to believe in conspiracies because everything will eventually just be out in the open anyway. That nobody who was in charge of whatever shadowy thing that you want to do. I mean, it's Hal Holbrook's line in President's Men to Redford. These are not very smart guys.
Yeah.
And they made a lot of mistakes. And that is true in every single case. There is no, you know, there's no secret, you know, really super intelligent deep state. Because you think about the people who actually got involved in that work, and they're not suave super geniuses. They're kind of like Redford. They're just guys, you know? And it's just a matter of, you know, you guys had the technology to do this thing, and you had the right lack of scruples. And so you went ahead and did it. And that's the secret of America. And I think Redford putting a human face on disillusionment, and also how exciting it would be to finally be like, oh, wow, there it is. This is the thing I've always suspected, and it's real, and it's right there. And, like, you know, there's that brilliant, brilliant moment where Sidney Poitier is getting so pissed off and paranoid when David Strathairn says, anybody want to crash a jet?
Yes.
And you're just like, yeah, because that was what they had to think that was the thinking in the room as they're doing all this secret conspiracy shit, is they actually did it, is that they came up with the idea, wouldn't it be fun to just ruin fucking democracy and assassinate JFK or whatever, you know, whatever thing you want to choose. And they did it. And they did it because they wanted money. In every single case, it was money and power, and that was all they ever wanted. And, you know, that's the beauty of America really is that it always seems like it's this Oliver Stone, you know, this goes all the way to the top thing, you know, and there's 1,000 chess pieces and, you know, and then you actually get to the meat of what it is. And it's lunatics and idiots. And that is it. That is the entire history of the 20th century in America. It was just, it was mama's boys and drunks and freaks, like, you know, yeah. And so it's tempting, I think, to really want there to be this, you know, it's the alien abduction stuff. Why do we always, you know, hear the stories about people who like want so badly to believe that they were abducted by aliens? And why do we want to continue to believe in all this stuff? And it's like, because that's more interesting. It is more interesting to think that there is some intelligence out there. There is something that is thought through absolutely every facet of their existence and our existence. And they've traveled through planets and they're super geniuses and they've got technology that would, and they care about us. And that's really the thing. It's loneliness, the profound loneliness of, I wish I could be abducted because then I would be interesting. And furthermore, somebody would care enough about me to have pulled me from nothing, you know, to turn me into fucking Harry Potter or whatever. And that is just so much a part of, I mean, it's why Harry Potter was always more popular over here than it was anywhere else in the world. Yeah. It's, you know, we've got the fucking theme parks and the pop-up shops and all this shit is because we are so desperate to be thought of as exceptional. Yes. And the beauty of sneakers is nobody's exceptional. You know, like, it's the only reason that he's pulled back into this web is because somebody thought that he was the same thing, you know, they thought that he was, you know, like, it's the Christ and Antichrist of intelligence.
Yes.
And that it all should mean something. And ultimately, none of it means anything.
Was that a huge incentive for them to be a part of the movie? Because I would imagine, like, that's what I long for in these great 90s, late 80s movies that you were a part of and that were made at this time, is they just seem to have these absolutely loaded casts, and everyone who's a bit player are now really great, phenomenal, accomplished actors who just wanted to be a part of the show. Like, I want to go play with those guys. They seem like they're going to be a blast. So did you find that with people like Donald Logue and Lee Garlington on this movie?
Definitely. And Lee... You know, as Lee said to me, she says, I get to be kissed by Robert Redford. You know, why wouldn't I want to do this? I think everybody had a sense. Certain, when Bob came on the movie, and he was really the first person we cast, it opened up the world.
Yes.
Everybody wants to be in a movie with Robert Redford. And I think Sydney was next, and then Danny. And it's like, and each one just made the whole far more attractive.
Yes.
To the point where we had our pick of just the best people, and our casting sessions were just filled with wonderful people who wanted to be in the movie. And Donald, I don't think Donald had done much at that point.
No.
He's great. He's great in this. You know, he's so good.
You described this right at the beginning with Parks and Lasker, you guys going like, tech dirty doesn't. And so that one line that you said in a previous interview, if you just look at the list of actors that are in the Dirty Dozen, the magic of it isn't just that it's a phenomenal World War II, Robert Aldrich team up movie, fantastic, but it's an intergenerational, like, feast. Lee Marvin, Borgnine, Charles Bronson, Cassavetes, Jim Brown, like, George Kennedy, like, Robert Ryan, this group of people who will be either are immediately right then and there. I mean, even Donald Sutherland, like, they're the most important actors in multiple genres or in, like, previous decades or forthcoming decades that are all coming together. And so I think that that's, like, one thing that people can keep going back to Dirty Dozen for, and why the magic maybe was never quite the same again if they tried to replicate it, is because we've got every great actor that are working in multiple genres coming together for this one thing. And the team up is
everything that all of those different genres and styles and the blend of that, this cocktail, which I think that you guys, whether it was intended or kind of unintentional, and afterwards you're just like, oh my God, we kind of did it for our generation. That's why this is a tech dirty dozen in the truest sense. It's because you've able to manifest that same sort of weird and wonderful intergenerational connection between the cast, and obviously the material is phenomenal. Like the story sells it itself. It's not just the actors, but it's once you get the right people, it elevates everything else.
And you know, Bishop was always our age when we were writing, and over the 10 yeah. years in which we wrote, it started when we were all about 30, and Bishop yes. was 30.
Yes.
And in that very first draft, it said in the description of Kreese is the old guy, he's 40.
Yes.
By the time we made the film, we were all 40, early yeah. 40s. But still, we imagined Bishop would be our age. And when I was told that Redford was reading the script, we hadn't sent it to him, but one of his agents gave it to him. My first thought was, no, that's 10 years older than what we're looking for. And then I read the script that night. I imagined him in every scene, and it was the best version of the script I'd ever imagined.
Yes.
That having him be a little older, it made it more poignant, it made it more important, it made it funnier, it made it tenser. Everything about it got better.
Yeah, because he's lost a step.
Right.
That's the thing. If he's right on 40 with you guys, there's never a doubt that they're going to get across. What's great is that your crew are misfits. They've all kind of in their way lost a step, or they've made a mess up, which is why they're all there. I think it's actually, there's a contemporary show, the magic of it is a terrific show called Slow Horses very recently, which is with Gary Oldman. It's that they're misfits. And so every time they get into this, they get into whatever the recent 6-episode season of it all is, it's like, yeah, they're misfits. So there's every situation, they're not going to just go in there and be accomplished and be great spies. They might ruin it because they're all deeply flawed. So I think you're so right there.
Also, the Redford's character, it's about a guy who wants to get his name back.
Yeah.
And that's more poignant if he's 50 than if he's 40.
Absolutely.
You know, this feels like his last chance to do that. If he's 40, well, he'll have more opportunities. It just, things that we hadn't even thought about got better.
Yes. And it's gnawing at him for longer.
Right.
And right. it's the perfect reflection, because he's still a very politically active and engaged guy, and he knows why he did what he had to do. He was being a disruptor, you know, he was being a bit of an anarchist at the time, he and Cosmo, when they were, you know, silly young kids, and you make mistakes when you're young, and the punishment is long. The punishment right. is long.
And ultimately, I mean, Cosmo's story is about a guy who wants to get his friend back.
Yes.
And that's more poignant if you're 50 than if you're 40. You know, it's like everything about that relationship, when you see them at the end arguing on the roof and you realize it's just these two kids who fucked up. That's more powerful that they're a little bit older than if they had been our age.
Yes.
Everything got better with that choice.
This has been the second episode of Too Many Minutes, a Sneakers podcast. I've been your host, Blake Howard. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to keep following us along, make sure you subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to check out what's happening on the website, you can go to oneheatminute.com. If you want to reach out to us, email us at mail@oneheatminute.com. And if you want to support us, head over to Patreon/oneheatminute, where you can chip in to not only this series, but our other mini mega series, Minhunter, the series on Manhunter, which is happening right now. You can get video episodes, you can get exclusives, and this series, which is now going to be going for the next 7 weeks, has so many more things coming, including a couple of bonus uncut episodes with some of our guests of the series so far. Thank you once again to Lee Zachariah. Thank you so much to Carrie Corgan. Thank you to Scout DeFoya, and thank you to Phil Adam Robinson. If you want to find all of those amazing people, links to their incredible work are all in the show notes or back on the actual link to this episode on oneheatminute.com. Thank you so much for listening. We'll catch you on the next episode of Too Many Minutes. next week.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, like Alo or Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret? With Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whatever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/try to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/try.